David Hunter, contrarian macro strategist. Welcome to The Competent Investor. Thanks for joining me.
Hey, Tom, good to see you again.
David, you and I have been speaking for over 5 years now. I can't believe that. And in that time, you've been consistent in calling for a melt-up scenario that keeps, you know, to be fair, keeps on getting pushed higher and higher, way higher than many people thought it could. I mean, certainly you and I think. So let's start with your targets at this point for how high you think the markets have yet to go here.
I raised targets because I don't think we've talked in a while. I raised targets in my fourth quarter letter back in early October for the equity markets. I raised my S&P target to 9,500. I had raised it back after the April swoon right at the bottom to 8,700 from 8,000. And then with the move we saw over the summer and into the fall, it looked like there were legs, so I raised it to 9,500. My NASDAQ target now is 32,000. I've been raised in October from 30,000. My Dow target was raised from, I think it was 60 to 65,000. And my Russell target, which is the most aggressive of all, is 3,800 now. So it had been 3,400 and I raised to 38. So I feel like those are good numbers at this point. I didn't change them in my January letter. I think obviously there's still 40, and in Russell's case, maybe more than 40% away. But I do think we're going to see that kind of a final steep run into the top.
So, David, what do you see as a catalyst for, let's say, ringing the bell at the top here?
Yeah, for me, what will probably convince me it's time to exit stage left or whatever is going to be sentiment. You know, when we are seeing sentiment obviously move up, as I've said for a couple of years now, you know, from the October 2022 low. Most institutional investors fought this market all the way up until very recently. I mean, even when they were, you know, giving higher numbers for their year ahead numbers, they were kind of couching it in very cautious language, and they're mostly fully invested probably, but they're more defensively invested, and they, you know, they had one worry or another that always was there. So every time we saw a sell-off of, you know, 3, 4, 5%, they got bearish again, or at least started talking more negatively. So the wall of worry got rebuilt. Mm-hmm. Now we're at the point where I think you have more and more of the institutions getting on board the bullish bandwagon. And as we move up, and retail's been surprising, even from the April swoon last April, retail bought down there, whereas the institutions were going negative and selling. And, you know, the strategists out there, I was one of the few that I raised targets when that happened. Most of the strategists on the street were lowering targets and saying the top's in. Some were really getting very negative. Retail stayed pretty resilient. Bought into that, saw it as an opportunity, and they've remained pretty bullish all the way through. So it's more the institutions that are getting on board now. I think in the next, you know, 3, 4, 5 months ahead, we're going to see that sentiment move to a level where I'm going to become uncomfortable for the first time in a long time. I mean, I think for the first time in this cycle from 2022, it'll be the first time where I'll be starting to talk about, you know, this thing's getting very, very extended. Mm-hmm.
David, when we think about, let's say, what comes next, you know, you've called for a global bust several times here. What do you think, I mean, to kind of reiterate this question, what do you think is the, let's say, the catalyst for that? For that bell at the top, you know, is it implosions of these sovereign debt bubbles, like, you know, maybe the yen carry trade? Is it sentiment starting to recognize its own overbullishness or overzealousness? What do you think that is?
Yeah, so the bust refers to the economy and the financial system as opposed to the market. I'm calling for potentially an 80% bear, so they go hand in hand. The bust itself, I think there are several potential catalysts. Certainly, Japan is one. China's, even though they're seeing some uptick lately, China's still got lots of problems. Even Xi, I think, has some problems. They just had to, they just basically took out a bunch of the military leaders. So there's always those potentials out there. I think the one you need to focus on is really Europe. And I think their banks are in rough shape, as are some of the others. I mean, the Asian banks. Japan's, got the risks because of what's going on over there. China certainly, even though it's a closed economy, you never know what's going to happen. Basically, it comes back to, for me, the reason I've talked about a bust for so many years is it comes back to the fact that we are so far above the debt levels we had in 2008, 9. We're so much more extended leverage wise, and leverage works both ways. It helps enhance on the upside, but when you get a recession, it really can exacerbate. And I worry, even though our banks are in better shape than they were in 2008 by far, I mean, they were forced to decapitalize, to deleverage, get more capital, but deleverage. But you look at Canada. Canada didn't learn our lessons. They basically are where we were then. Their real estate is a problem, and their balance sheets are not what they were in 2008. Europe, I think there's several big European banks that I think have risk. So I think it's more likely to come out of one of those areas, Europe in particular, but it could be some of these other areas than it is the U.S. But the U.S., obviously, we're a small world now, and counterparty risk and everything else, our banks will not skate through that. They'll be hit pretty hard. So I think that's probably the biggest thing is leverage. As I've said for a while, nobody talks about it, but under the surface, the statistics look great coming out of the pandemic. Looks like we were fully recovered. Under the surface, a lot of things didn't recover. There's a lot of fragility in the system, I think, because we closed down the entire world for a quarter and then printed our way out of it. A lot of small businesses in this country and a lot of, I'm sure, around the world, there's a lot of fragility. So as this thing rolls over, I think some of that'll start showing up. As I say, when the tide goes out, you start seeing the things under the surface. I think those are big things, and then the other big one that always seems to be a part of a downturn is Fed policy and central bank policy. And I think it's you're kind of seeing it if you look. I mean, I don't study trueflation's numbers to know exactly what the difference is, but you got trueflation showing what I think is really more likely happening, which is we are moving towards where inflation's coming down. We are moving towards a deflation, and yet you've got central banks around the world, and particularly our central bank and our Fed leader, much more concerned about inflation. And that's classically what central banks do, is miss something at a turning point and zig when they should have zagged. And so I think a Fed policy error is very likely here. Now you can look, and I've been very defensively supportive of Powell in terms of everybody's criticizing him, particularly the president, but many others for what the Fed is doing. And I go, but step back. I've been the first one to say rates would be coming down faster, et cetera. But you look at the economy and you go, how can you fault him? He's brought inflation down from, high single digits to below 3%. And although everybody kept pushing him to cut rates, he kind of did it more carefully. And right now, you can't fault him. Now, that doesn't mean, because I do believe that when we look forward, there's a lot, long lag to some of this stuff. When we look forward, that we'll find that they are actually far too restrictive right now, and the price we'll pay for that is probably later this year. So it's those three things really that I think causes a bust.
Before we get, more into the weeds on Fed policy and central bank policy around the world, what does a global bust look like to you, David? Is it a dramatic sell-off and crash, or is it more like a grinding contagion that spreads from sector to sector over the course of, several months?
Yeah, well, again, bust refers to what makes it a bust is it's a bad recession, but then it's accompanied by a financial crisis. So the most classic one to point to is surprisingly the one we just had in 2008-9. I think that one I don't call a bust because we kind of pulled back from the cliff. We were on the edge of the cliff. And when they almost shut down the commercial paper market, which would have really hit some big corporations very hard and others, they acted just in time to avoid a bust. This time, I think just the mindset, that our central banks say we're never going back to that place again. We're not going to do QE infinity. We're not going to, means there's going to be a lag to when we respond properly. And it's in that pause, in that delay, that I think we can go over the cliff this time. So it's basically 2008-9 on steroids is what I describe it as, which means for a short period of time, if you can imagine October of 2008, if they hadn't made sure the commercial paper market stayed open, if they hadn't bailed out the banks immediately, et cetera, we could have seen the bust then. This time around, I think because it's the next cycle, basically, they're going to be very reluctant to repeat what everybody on Wall Street, as well as on Main Street, thinks was a mistake. So it's that delay. It's not that they won't come in. They'll come in bigger than they've ever come in, but there's going to be a delayed response. So, I mean, you can see it already in terms of Powell and the Fed. They're still fighting the last war. They're so worried about inflation right now, and they think they haven't learned the lessons of the past of leads and lags, and they're kind of everything is they don't want to make mistakes, so everything is right to the minute. It's like what was CPI this week? What was the jobs number last month? And the leads and lags to policy are 6, 9 months at least. And so you're guaranteeing it can be late. And when you have the leverage we have in the system, that lateness is a problem. So I'd say a bust. I think overall the cycle will be not necessarily any longer than 2008-9. I've said the bust itself maybe 12 to 18 months. The market will lead the bust coming out. So the market might be the bear market might last 9 months. Or it could even be faster, but it won't be it won't be 2 months. You'll have different legs to the bear market. It won't be straight from top to bottom. You might go down 30%, come back halfway, go down another 40 or 50%, come back halfway, and then have a final sell-off. So it'll take those consolidation or bear market rallies might last a month or two. So it all depends on how much those counter rallies, how much time they take as to how long the bear market lasts. So, could be a year, but it might be shorter.
It's interesting to think about the nuance of how the Treasury and the central bank are operating right now, and how, in a way, we're coming quite close to the end of Powell's term, right? He's done at the, in May here. But I was listening to Secretary or Treasury Secretary Bessent the other day, in, a bit of a longer form interview, and he was talking about the idea that they're not against coming in to make sure that if there's a liquidity crisis, that they respond accordingly. But as you're saying, they're not they don't want to completely support Wall Street and the stock markets. But in a way, they what he's kind of signaling is that if there's a, more so a banking crisis or a specific liquidity crisis, that they're willing to step in that case. So do you think that there is, a little bit of a shift of strategy, considering Bessent's words and also the idea that maybe the new Fed chair is more aligned with a strategy like that?
Yeah, for sure. I think you're going to see as we move towards May that the Fed will not be fighting the administration like they are now. I really am torn because I do think Powell can be a little political, and by now I mean Trump's alienated him for sure by calling him a moron, et cetera. So even if he's trying to be objective, it's hard for anybody to be objective when that's who you're facing, what facing off with. But generally, I would, as I said before, you can't fault the policy, and it's not just Powell. He's got, and it's not because he's browbeating him. He's got most of his committee pretty much in line with his thinking, and so. There may be some politics there, but more than that, I think they're looking back. They're fighting the last war, or they're overly concerned about inflation when they shouldn't be, et
They're
cetera. So,
still fighting transitory inflation, right?
yes, right. Yeah, exactly. They don't want to be accused of making that mistake again. That's exactly the war they're fighting.
Well, I mean, David, this brings up a really interesting point, though, is that, we're looking at replacing the Fed chair, which is one vote out of, I believe it's 12, right? So how much weight, or is it basically the overall direction that the Fed chair has influence over the entire committee? And how does that, do we think of the Fed as one person when in reality you need a consensus among 12 chairs?
Yeah, every Fed chair has a little bit different. I guess Greenspan certainly had pretty much full control of his. Volcker pretty much control of his, and I think Powell's got certainly most of the committee pretty much has his back. So the Fed chair's got influence if things are kind of on where there's the committee is split. He can weigh in and carry a lot of weight, and particularly when he's got a relationship with the committee like Powell does. But Fed chair can be overruled if the committee, and if most of the committee, I'm not saying this is the case, but if most of the committee had TDS, it wouldn't matter who the chair was because they would probably fight him, and it would be very dysfunctional. I don't expect that at all. And frankly, I think the economy is going to be making the decision for them. As I've said for a long time, I'm definitely somebody that supports most of what Trump does, but I've said it's a mistake to be going after Powell that the bond market sets rates or determines rates. The Fed controls the overnight money, that's it. And yes, the Fed certainly, Wall Street hangs on every word and, on every meeting. But in truth, the bond market, if they see inflation coming down or the economy softening, they're going to move rates before the Fed, even no matter what the Fed wants to do. So I just think it's been a lot of wasted capital fighting Powell, and you come across looking like a brute, but I get it. I understand he believes that rates are hurting the housing market, hurting the economy, et cetera, and he wants to bring them down. But it's not the Fed. If the Fed cut too aggressively too soon, it can have, as we saw, a year ago, more than a year ago, it can have the opposite effect. Rates, long rates can go up. So I think we make too much as investors, particularly Wall Street, spends too much time talking about who's going to be Fed chairman and what's the effect going to be if Powell stays on or what have you. We don't like dysfunction. I don't want to see that, but I don't really think it's going to make a lot of difference in terms of the ultimate outcome or even shape of the next year. It's I think we're heading for a bust no matter who the Fed chairman is. And in terms of the administration, and I think Scott Bessent is the best Treasury Secretary in history. I think we're really lucky to have somebody who not only came from Wall Street, but at least for me, he thinks like I do. I mean, he really does have a control, an understanding of markets and macro in ways that nobody that's been in that place before has. Mnuchin did pretty good job, and other Rubin was pretty good. I guess that was with Clinton. But Bessent really does have a handle on all of that, and he's also not afraid to speak his mind on some things. He's not a wallflower, that's for sure. He's well spoken in terms of explaining himself and in explaining things. So that's a big plus. Trump still has, when he wants to do something, he'll do it. And they're pretty much on the same page on a lot of things. What I would say though is that this administration, this Fed, Bessent, none of them are looking for a bust. People say, "Oh, do they know this is coming?" But they're just not going to tell the public. Or no, this is something that's totally not on anybody's radar or hardly anybody's radar, and certainly not any policymaker's radar. So it's going to surprise when it comes. And what I've said about Fed policy, and I think it's true even if Bessent has inclinations towards, responding quickly, it's not just the quick response, it's right-sized policy. And if you're going to have something where things are coming apart much faster and much deeper than even 2008, 9, nobody's going to be ahead of time prepared for what it's going to take to turn that around. And then add in the fact, as I said before, that I think the inclination is not to repeat the mistakes of 2008, 9. So they're going to be coming in gradually, initially, very gradually and reluctantly, and then realize, like a deer in headlights, oh my God, that's not nearly enough. And then they come with another tranche, that's not nearly enough. And so it's going to take them a good long time to get a good long time in terms of crashing markets and crashing economies. A day is a long time in that environment, or a week or a month. So, but it'll take them time to get the right size policy. In the meantime, things are going to continue to be free falling. So, and if I'm right that we're going to have a banking crisis of a magnitude even bigger than 2008, 9, that's you're going to have bank failures dominoing across the world. And again, my focus is the U.S. and the Fed. This is a global bust. So it's going to take a lot of, and we also don't have cooperation globally. I mean, we've got a lot of, I'm not sure how Mark Carney and Donald Trump are going to meet in terms of minds immediately. They'll get there because they're going to have to. But there's going to be a lot of that we're in a world where people make stupid decisions because of their politics.
Well, that's actually, where I wanted to go next is this, you mentioned the idea of a banking crisis. How will banks be affected, and does that, put into jeopardy people's savings that they have held within these banks? And does the FDIC really, the FDIC insurance really mean something at that point?
Yeah, that's one place where I've been pretty adamant that the ultimate response is going to be, I think, just looking at the US, it could be as much as 20 trillion or more in terms of new QE. So we did 5 trillion QE in response to the pandemic. We did 3.7 in QE after 2008-9, or in response to 2008-9, and that came over a few years. This could be 20 trillion coming in, like we saw in the pandemic, coming in over the course of a year or 18 months. That money is going to be used in so many different ways to try to, just like we saw in the pandemic, they did so many new things that they had never done before, and tried to figure out ways to help small business, help Wall Street, provide loans to those that really needed something to just get through this. You're going to see all that again, I'm quite sure. And it means there'll be plenty of money, because they'll do whatever it takes to stabilize the system and turn it up. That means there'll be plenty of money to fund. I have zero doubt that the FDIC will be funded to whatever their liability needs are to meet the 250,000 per institution threshold. So if somebody has 250,000 in a bank that's FDIC insured, they'll get that back. Beyond that, I can't know. I mean, I would presume that we might see even beyond that protected, but in Europe and other places, bail-ins are very possible. But I think in the US, I'm very comfortable in saying up to that 250 per institution, you shouldn't worry.
You know, it's interesting to try to consider what happens in that case, though. Like, let's say you have less than 250 in, I believe it's each account, right?
Now, it's each in, I think it's each institution.
Well, either way, if you
So
think about
you could have three accounts, but if you exceeded the 250, you'd be above
total.
the threshold. So it'll be your sum total in that institution can't go over 250 for the insurance. I think I'm right about that.
Okay. So in that case, though, if they come in with, $20 trillion worth of liquidity to, prop up or save the system, that 250, once you adjust it for that extra $20 trillion that is going to be created, the real value of that currency just gets destroyed by that liquidity as well.
Well, keep in mind there are leads and lags. That 20 trillion,
Of course.
my cycle forecast, or my long-term macro forecast, is that five, as I say, this is my talking about 20 trillion is not a an endorsement that that's what they should do. I'm just saying that's inevitable, is that whatever the number is, that's what they're going to have to do to save the system, and they will do that, I have no doubt. So, but then the lagged effects of that is going to be inflation, and ultimately hyperinflation, or what I define as hyperinflation, which could be 25% inflation by the early 2030s. But there's, the first year out of a bust, we're coming out of what I think will be a deflationary bust. So it'll take that first year just to get to low inflation again, and low single digit inflation. And second year, you might be mid to above mid inflation, mid single digit, and by the third year you're approaching double digit inflation, and by the fourth and fifth year you're roaring straight up like silver is now. So yeah, it's going to lead to a real purchasing power problem down the road, but in the period where you're in deflation, you're just glad to get your money back, and having your money back while inflation's not moving forward, you'll be fine. It's what you do with that money in the ensuing years that will make a difference as to whether you're one of those that says, yeah, I have 250, just using a number, I have $250,000, but it now, is only buying me what 100,000 or 150,000 used to buy me. So yeah, that's, I mean, that is going to be the problem to this. But as I say, I think it's inevitable that they'll try other things before they get to that. But ultimately, the only thing that can save a free falling system or the only thing that can move fast enough to save it is cash, is money. And so you'll see that. You'll see other things, they'll legislate things to try to save pension funds and save the money market funds. They'll probably have the, we won't break a buck policy again that they had back in 2008-9. Ultimately, yeah, the ultimate result is that we go from this bust into an inflationary cycle that's going to be our undoing, because you're also going to see to do 20 trillion in QE means they're probably going to do something equivalent in terms of treasury borrowing, government borrowing, so that, or if it's not 20, it's certainly a big number, so that the amount of debt that I quote the global number of 330 trillion today, by the time we get through the bust and on the other side of the bust, it could be 450 to 500 trillion. So we're not going to be deleveraging in this process. We're actually going to be more leveraged. And then we're going to have that much higher leverage facing 15, 20% inflation rate, inflation and interest rates.
And there's, in exactly as you explained, it's not, it doesn't end up being we're trying to save the dollar, therefore we have to sacrifice the bond market. It ends up being the idea of basically sacrificing both through probably undulating, back and forth, push and pull, kind of tug of war. But at the end, we're going to end up with both of those things being destroyed.
Exactly. Yeah. The end result is a dollar that now the dollar will get bid up, I think, in the second half of the bust as people see how bad it is. They flee to the safety of the dollar, because we're still the safest place. We have plenty of problems, but people will see this as the place where they trust it most, that they'll get their money back. So the dollar gets bid up as people buy treasuries from overseas, et cetera. So you'll have one last hurrah on the dollar. I'm calling for 82 on the dollar, what I call pre-bust, meaning this year, sometime this year. And then in when it starts going the other way, I think you could see 120 or higher on the dollar. So you have one last hurrah, and then I wouldn't be surprised to see the dollar under 50 by the end of the decade. So and going south from there. Just remember, we're not in isolation on this. It's all fiat currencies because they're all going to be doing the same thing. And so what that speaks to is obviously golden commodities do very well. If you want to preserve your purchasing power post bust, that's going to be your best way to do it.
Well, that's what I was going to say is like, how do we transport value through that time? And maybe we need to separate this in, bust, then post bust. How do you think about separating that and really protecting the, let's say, the value that you've built through that time?
Yeah, so probably the best way I can answer that is to talk about, I've talked about the equity market in terms of its run up here, and then it'll get hit to the tune of, I think, 70 or 80% on the downside in the bust. Same thing will happen with most assets. The only asset that I see, any asset of substance that I see holding up in the bust and actually appreciating the bust is the US Treasury. Bond or across the treasury curve, the notes and bonds and even the bills, if rates are coming down dramatically because they're printing money, and we're in deflation, those appreciate. But almost every other asset, certainly commodities, certainly precious metals, certainly the equity markets, junk bonds, even higher level investment grade bonds, they'll all be going down based on the risk that the economy's really hitting corporations hard, hitting demand hard. So going into the, in the bust, that's what you're going to face is a bear market and a lot of assets. Coming out of the bust, if we print that kind of money, let's say we did go down 80%. So if I'm right and we go to, I'll just use the S&P. If I'm right and we go to 9,500, that's basically around 2000, I think, is where the S&P would sell off if it were an 80% decline. So if you come out of the bust with all that money flowing into the capital markets first and then from there into the economy, there's going to be a cyclical market. I've said we're making a secular peak in the stock market that won't be seen again probably for decades. So the highs of this market that we're in now probably won't be seen for decades. But if you come out of a market that's down 80% and the S&P goes from 2000, it could easily go up threefold and be back at 6,000 or 7,000 or higher and not get back to the peaks because you're down so far, right? So that means there's going to be a cyclical bull market where people can make a lot of money in the first, probably the first 18 months out of the bottom. After that, as interest rates start moving up pretty fast, the PE multiples start getting compressed, and corporations start having to see margins starting to get squeezed again. It's 3, 4 years out for sure, so that profits are more constrained. They might be growing, but not growing that fast. Interest rates might be moving up towards double digits, so all of a sudden PE multiples on that kind of constrained earnings means your stocks aren't going anywhere. So then the trick then is to look at the sectors and the stocks, the companies that can produce earnings that can outpace inflation. And where is that? That's typically going to be industrials and commodities. So a company like Caterpillar, because they service the commodity industry, is going to have great earnings, right? And they'll have to deal with the cost rises, but they'll be able to price just because they'll have strong demand. Some industrials will do well. Certainly, the precious metals will be going through the roof, and other metals. Copper, I think, could go. Copper, I have a copper forecast right now for pre-bust of $8, and I may be low, but I'm certainly high on the street. I had a $6 number raised at 7 at the beginning of 2025. Then we had that tariff news, and it went down to like 450. I kept my $7 number, which I had, early 25 I had put in. And it didn't look like that was going to happen. And then obviously the last few months are starting to move. I think my $8 number that I put in January may prove low, but it's the end of cycle type pricing. And then in the bust, copper could fall to $1 or $2. I mean, and then coming out of there, I wouldn't be surprised to see copper north of 20. So you're going to see big runs in commodity prices. Energy is a big one. I have a, I've been the bear on the street in energy from 2022 when Russia invaded Ukraine. I've been bearish from probably 130 down, and certainly 120 down. And I've been using a number of once it got below 100, I lowered my number to mid 60s, and then lowered it to 60. So I'm at this point, I think you're in a trading range till the bust hits. So low 50s to mid 60s. If we get something in Iran that's not quick, it could certainly spike. But basically, oil's under pressure, demand is soft, and supply is large. I think you're going to see 30 or below in the bust. And then coming out of the bust, I think by the early 2030s, energy could be $500 a barrel. So energy should be at the top of people's list in terms of buying what you buy on the other side of the bust. And so same thing with precious metals. I'm looking for, my current target on silver is 125. I'll probably end up having to raise that in the next month or two. But I think it can fall in half or more in the bust, and then go to $500 has been my long-held target for early 2030s. I'm probably going to be low on that now that we've seen what's going on recently. And gold, I've had a long, current target of 5,500. I'll probably end up having to raise that sometime pre-bust. I think by the early 2030s, my number's been 20,000. So again, you can see coming out of a bust, and gold will get hit not as hard as silver, but get hit in the bust. So let's say the target becomes 6,000 and it falls to 4,000. From 4,000, it can go up fivefold to 20,000. And who knows if that's even a high enough number? So I think commodities in general, you know, all kinds of metals, steel, aluminum, etc., will have pricing power and will be able to outpace inflation and have a very big. We haven't had an industrial boom like that since the late 70s, early 80s. And that's what I think we'll be looking at, is something that's, you know, we're obviously doing a lot of reshoring that requires a lot of commodities. That's going to continue. And so there will be places after the bust where you can make a lot of money. But if you're in the wrong places and you're still buying growth stocks, when interest rates are going from close to zero up to 20%, you're going to be very sorry that you're in the wrong places. If you're buying utilities because, you know, yes, we're going to see more electric demand, you're going to be pretty disappointed because they're bought for their dividends and, you know, interest rates are going through the roof. So it's going to be very important to know that in a new cycle, you need to focus on new leadership, and that leadership is going to be commodity-led.
Mm-hmm. Well, David, that's another, you know, question I wanted to run by you, is this idea that, you know, a lot of the bull run in gold has been pointed as being driven by central bank buying over the last, you know, 4 or 5 years. This theme doesn't seem to be slowing. So how does, you know, obviously in a big liquidity crunch, everything goes down because of margin calls, you know, anything that is liquid gets sold. But how do you think the price of gold gets affected in a time like that because of those, you know, large institutional buyers that have been consistently and constantly driving that price?
Yeah, they'll certainly soften the blow. That's why I say, you know, you might have a 6,000, 4,000, I'm not saying that's the right number, but, yeah, you know, that's obviously a 33% drop as opposed to an 80% drop in the stock market, or maybe a 70% drop in silver, you know? So that will be a softening effect that will certainly ameliorate some of the decline. But, you know, if we're in deflation and the world's falling apart, there's going to be plenty of rethinking gold and saying, well, you don't earn anything. Gold doesn't pay a dividend, doesn't pay interest, doesn't do anything. There's a lot less demand for gold other than monetarily, other than for safety or security. And I'm not sure that's going to hold up here. You've seen it before. I mean, the thinking all of a sudden changes. So the central banks won't be so anxious to do that. The dollar moving up during the bust will mean there won't be so much focus on what the alternative needs to be. What do I need to own against the fiat currency? So there'll be lots of reasons for selling it, along with what you said, which is, you know, you sell what you can. Mm-hmm. So I think it'll, you know, it's not going to hold up as a, you know, in whole. It may outperform, but it's not going to hold up in a bust, particularly a deflationary bust. Mm-hmm. But it will be certainly one of the assets on the other side of the bust.
Yeah, it might be. So would it be better to be in cash at that point and then rebuy gold? Or, you know, does gold pull back the least in your mind through that
time? Yeah, it would.
Time?
Everybody has to kind of decide what, you know, what makes sense for them. But it certainly from a mathematical standpoint, my guess would be that cash, basically, if you've got most assets falling, cash without any gains, but just no losses, is a huge thing. And like I said, as long as you have your money spread so that you don't lose that cash, cash would seem to make a lot of sense. Treasuries would make even more sense because as long as the government has a printing press, as long as the Fed still has its printing press, you pretty much don't have to worry about defaults on US Treasuries. I can't say the same thing in other countries because, I don't know exactly. The likelihood is that's probably true elsewhere too. That money's, it's going to be like 2008, 9. As long as there's a printing press, the governments aren't, the sovereign debt isn't at risk, right? The problem we have is going to be when you skip over to the other side of the recovery cycle. If inflation moves up to 20 or 25% in this country, if interest rates follow that as they do, there's a good chance that T-bills will be, and I was a money manager back in 1981 and two. There's a good chance that treasury bills will be over 20%. There's a good chance that the long bond will be somewhere between 15 and 20%. And we'll have twice, probably twice the debt we have today to service. That equation doesn't get solved, right? You're bankrupt. The government won't have enough revenue to even pay the interest on the debt. Never mind fund military, fund welfare, et cetera. Somewhere along the line, as we approach the end of this decade, we cross over that place where, because early on they'll be printing more money to and selling more bonds to help fund their needs. But as that fuels more inflation and rates move up faster than they can keep up with it, you cross over a point where that makes sense because the more you print, the more you owe, or the more you can't keep up with it. So there is a point, I think, late this decade where we cross over, and the reality is we've lived way beyond our means. We no longer have a way to allow that. The printing press is closed down. You can't print money because it just is like pouring gas on a forest fire, and so once that happens, the game's over. The Ponzi scheme has ended, and I think then it's a matter of time. You might be able to kind of take from Peter to pay Paul for a little while, et cetera. But I think by the time you get to somewhere between 2033 and 35, you have a collapse of the system. Not just the US, but around the world, because we all have done it. It's been one huge Ponzi scheme that started post-depression, post-Great Depression, and built up slowly early on. But we're now, the Ponzi scheme's gone parabolic, right? We're racing ahead in terms of our debt numbers and all of that at levels we never saw before. So that's a sign that you're going to burn that whole thing out. And it's like watching, a parabolic stock. When it reaches its crescendo and rolls over, it goes down almost as fast as it went up.
So, David, when we see the strength in the metals at that time, what do you think happens to the mining stocks, the precious metals mining stocks?
I think they are going to be huge winners. I think the post-bust era, you're going to see lots of money made. It will be the dot-com stocks of the early 2000s. It will be the AI stocks of today. Mining stocks will be big, big winners, as will a lot of, oil exploration stocks, et cetera. It's the need for materials, commodities, means that prices are going to go through the roof.
So, David, before we kind of move on here, can you give us a quick refresher of, let's say, your GDX, your gold, energy targets, all of the targets for this, let's say, this intermediate top here?
Yes. For I'll start with gold. That my GDX and GDXJ targets, those are the miners and the junior miners. I did raise targets there twice, except in October, my early October letter. I raised GDX from 75, I think it was, or maybe a 65, up to, trying to think, 120. I raised GDXJ from 100 up to 170. And then in my January letter, I raised those from there from 120 to 150 for GDX and from 170 to 210 on GDXJ. So that's where I'm at now. On silver, SIL, which is large miners, major miners, it was 75, and last October I raised it to 150. And then I raised it to, I'm trying to think, 100, 180, I think, is my current target. And for SILJ, which I had a long held target of 35, and it was, it was 10 a year ago. It was people going, no, I think that target's going to be hard to reach. I raised it in October from 35 to 60. And these are big changes because I don't normally, I'm looking ahead, but that was, I had, fortunately, I did see things that told me I even as far away as I was, I needed to go higher. So I raised 60, and then I raised it again in January to 75. So that's where I'm at now. In terms of oil, I don't really expect oil to do anything but kind of trade in a range till the bust hits. So my real focus, I've been saying target is, trading ranges, low 50s to 65 or mid 60s. In the bust, as I said, 30 or below. Post bust, or and so for the for XLE, the ETF for oil stocks, I the only target I have is, it was $20, but they split it 2 for 1, so it's $10 for XLE in the bust, and that I think the stock is somewhere up in the high 40s maybe, so that's a big drop. And then coming out, I don't have post bust numbers, but those things will all go up a lot. Copper, as I said, my copper target currently is $8. I have a target for COPX, which is the copper producers. Had been, I think, 75, and I raised it to 100 last October, and now it's at 120. So, still good upside there, I think. Any others? I think that's pretty much it. Trying to think if there are any other ETFs that really are important.
We've kind of covered, let's say, those are the upside targets here. Do you see, is this a roundabout, let's say, 30 to 50% pullback in many of those numbers that you mentioned, in that initial bust?
Now, in the bust, I don't have, different phases of the bust, but in the bust, if the market's going down 80%,
Well, let's say after that, intermediate pop, sorry. That's what I mean.
those are my tops for, those are the pre-bust tops. So before we start going down, those are our peaks. And in the bust, where I think the market's going to go down 80%, I presume these things will go down pretty close to that. They're cyclical stocks. Their price are going to get hit, et cetera. I will tell you, just to give you an idea, we've had tremendous runs, and everybody says the miners have lagged. Yeah, they've lagged because silver's done so much and gold's done very well, but they've come up. In many cases, they're up threefold or more in the last year. So I am calling for, and I don't usually try to short term it, but I think this is a big enough correction. I think we're very close, and I haven't seen what silver's doing today, but I think we're very close to a, short term top, where we could have a 20 to 30% correction in the price of silver. That's a big hit. So if it can do that just in a correction, imagine what it can do in a bust. So
Right.
same thing with the miners. I think the miners can come down maybe 25% in a correction. So if they can do that in just a correction, and by the way, that correction means we have another leg up from there. So silver, my target 125 now is going to have to be raised, I think, at some point. But I'll probably do it during the correction. I want to see what what things look like during the correction. But I, for sure, I think I'm going to have to raise both gold and silver targets. Not sure about the miners
What are
because
those?
they're
What are those targets now?
silver is 125. I would guess I'm probably going to be raising it by, 40 or 50 bucks maybe, but I don't know that yet. I really want to see. And then gold is 5,500. I wouldn't be surprised if I had to raise that. It's almost at 5,500 now. If we get a correction in gold, silver, like I said, could correct as much as 30%. Gold, I would guess, probably corrects 10 or a little more. So, if gold's 5,500 at the top, because I think we're very close, whether it's this week or early next week, I think we're within days of a top, probably, or certainly a week of a top, week and a half, or less. If gold tops near 5,500, it can probably come back. I'm trying to. It might even do more than 10, but certainly something in the high fours would make sense. So it's not going to get hit as hard as silver by any means in a correction, and then come out of that and probably go to higher highs for both metals.
So, David, once we get that, let's say that bust or that in some ways that global reset, does are you optimistic? Does life look something like a good thing after that?
I think we're obviously we're late in it. What I call a super cycle is a period, a long cycle between two depressions. So the Great Depression of the 1930s, and what I think will be an even greater depression in the 20 mid 2030s and beyond. So if I'm saying that that's what we're headed for, I'm not optimistic about our future 10 years out. I do think there are great opportunities post bust. And what I tell everybody is your fighting chance in what's coming, I think, is to get your financial house in order first going into the bust. Make sure you don't ride it all the way back down. Clean up any debt you can, and then come out the other side. And if you invest properly, there's certainly things that are going to be five and ten baggers in stocks, and for even the average investor, you're going to be able to, coming out of the bottom of the bust, you're going to be able to make three or four times your money in mutual funds or anything, ETFs, I should say. But if you write it down, you're just trying to get your money back. If you've actually protected your capital, there's an opportunity to get your house in order and give you a fighting chance. What I describe in terms of what comes after the recovery cycle that follows the bust is we're going to have, if I'm right, no money for welfare, no money for unemployment, no money or limited, if at all limited. Social Security bankrupt, Medicare very, very limited, if at all. Medicaid. You're just not going to have the support system that everybody's grown up on, and that means everybody's fending for themselves. That's not. I can't pretend to envision exactly what that means, but it doesn't speak to me to something that's going to be friendly. I mean, it's there's going to be a Crime's going to go up big time. Violence probably going to go up big time as people, fight for survival. I hope I'm wrong. I hope a lot of what Trump is doing cleans up a lot of the debt, and that somehow the world gets its act together and we can kick the can down the road for lots more cycles. I just have my doubts.
David, is there anything that we haven't covered? Maybe, something on your mind that, let's say, you don't get asked too often.
Yeah, I'll say the thing we have not covered is bonds, and I think obviously rates are ticking up here again today. I think we're very close. Bonds are putting in a 2-year bottom. Basically, have been they came down prior to that 2 years, but they were basically been in a very rounding bottom here, kind of flat trading area for a couple of years, tight trading range. I think what we're going to see is we emerge from this on the upside in terms of bonds and on the downside in terms of rates. I think rates during this last, whether it's 3 months, 4 months, 5 months, I don't know, but during this last run in the stock market, I think rates coming down are going to be part of what drives it. So you're going to have lower inflation, lower rates, an economy that is still holding together, maybe more than that based on what we see right now, but at least holding together. No, you're going to hear no recession, et cetera. And that's what I think drives this last move in the stock market. A big part of it will be, I think the 10-year can drop from, we're currently 4.25. It can drop to 3% in this next, 3, 4, 5 months, I think, probably more like 5 or 6 months. But if you can move from 4.25 to 3%, that's a lot of tailwind for the market. And then if I'm right at all about, second half of this year, later in the year, sometime, this thing rolling over, the market peaking, and then the economy rolling over and it's starting to pick up speed. During the bust is when rates can fall from whether it's 2.5, 3%, when that really gets going. I think you could see a 10-year at zero. So a 0% 10-year, and again, people go, that's impossible. Who's going to buy? The Fed's going to be buying up every bond they can find to do QE of that magnitude. Institutions are going to be buying for safety and saying, we may not earn much, but we can't afford to lose, so we're going to buy treasuries. And short rates are probably going to be negative, so they'll be happy to have zero. And the 30-year might be selling at a quarter or half percent yield. But in a deflationary environment, that's money. So I think the bond market that everybody's been so anxious about may finally turn the corner here pretty soon, and be part of the wind at her back.
David, there's been an idea kind of thrown around here, and obviously not officially, but an idea that if the Treasury and the Fed instituted a gold-backed bond of some sort, that would or could spur more demand for that. Do you think that that's a possibility or something that could happen?
Yeah, I struggle with the things because Trump certainly is willing to do things we've never done before, and they're thinking about trying to solve their problem solvers, I think, more than we've had in the past. So, stable coin, gold back bond, et cetera. I just don't think you can do anything in a magnitude that's going to offset what our problem is. So I think it can temporarily cause some excitement and cause things to hold up beyond what I might expect. But ultimately, I think the numbers are just too huge. I mean, this has been 90 or 100 years in the making, and we're at levels where, again, this isn't the cycle where I worry about sovereign debt, but think about when the printing press goes away and most of that debt out there that we quote, 330 trillion, the biggest part of that increase is sovereign debt in this cycle, certainly. When they reach the point where they can't service that, there's nothing out there you can do, I don't think, to offset that kind of magnitude. We throw around trillions today, but hundreds of trillions is a whole different story.
Well, David, I think that's a good place to kind of end it for today. Tell everybody about your, is it your quarterly letter that you write?
Yeah, I write a macro letter that I put out quarterly. It's by subscription. I have to say, it's become problematic when X Musk or his software engineers decided to change the messaging system to an encrypted system that's called chat. It's got a lot of wrinkles and a lot of glitches in it. A lot of the time when I, and so I used to say, just direct message me and I'll provide you information on the my letter, because it's by cost, it has a cost. I still say that, but then when we get to the next step where most of the time they can see the what I put out there for them. But then when we start going back and forth to exchange information, et cetera, I don't find chat is reliable, so I tell people then I'll provide an email and then we can communicate there. So the initial step is to still direct message me, through chat, but then just understand that if you don't he you somehow don't get a message from me, it's the glitch in chat, not me. And so keep trying. Normally we can figure it out, but it's caused me a lot more having to put in a lot more time or go back and forth with people, because lots of times it says messages did not go through, and yet they still will see it lots of times, but I can't see that my message was sent. I wish they could fix that, because I don't
Well then,
understand how.
why don't you give people your, do you want to give people your email instead?
No, I don't do that. That's why I haven't come to direct message, because I just don't want to fill my box with all kinds of people. So,
Your X profile is at Dave H. Contrarian, right?
that's correct, and I am on X pretty much every day, answering questions, commenting on what I see in the markets. So that's pretty much how I communicate out there. I know people look for websites and stuff. I do not have a website, but I am on X most of the time. So look for me there.
Excellent. Perfect, David. Always a pleasure to speak with you, and we'll look forward to doing it again.
Yeah, thanks, Tom.